Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media right here in Troy. And I am Lavonia Mallory.
And I am Guy Schaefer. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we have first, we hear from Matt Wilson, the new executive director of Beyond Plastics. Then on Drop the Mic, we speak with hip-hop producer August, a.k.a. Extrodance. Next, Willie Terry brings us coverage of the Troy Irish Genealogy Society's forum on the Troy Draft Riot of 1863. After that, on Upstate Housing, Michelle Massurgeon interviews David Banks, a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. And then to close out the show, Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Chet Hardin about his investigative work on Nexium. But first, here are the headlines.
Troy's $10 million South Troy Industrial Road Project, which was designed to get tractor trailers off local streets, cut pollution in the neighborhoods, and spur economic growth, has hit a roadblock as Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin has not signed off on the final documents. City and county officials say Mayor Patrick Madden and the city's county legislatures, all Democrats, this month wrote McLaughlin, a Republican, asking him to sign the documents that were hand-delivered to the county's attorney office on September 20th.
A proposed 2.5% increase in water and sewer rates in Albany will be the topic of discussion at a public hearing. The Albany Water Board will host the public hearing from 6 to 7 p.m. Thursday at 10 North Enterprise Drive in Albany. The rate bump would increase the average residential bill by $10.80 per year and the minimum bill by $5.34 per year, according to a news release.
Is that Albany County or Albany City?
I'm not certain.
Thinking about my water bill right now.
Worth looking into.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM in Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, and I'm still Lavonia Mallory.
And I continue to be Guy Schaefer. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, send an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. That's hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
Two snaps.
Up first, Matt Wilson is the new executive director of Beyond Plastics. He discusses a relationship between plastics, fracking, and climate, and campaigns to curb single-use plastics, including plastic straws. He spoke at the Beyond Plastics Forum at Hunter College with more than 150 people in attendance. With Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
So we're talking with Matt Wilson, the new executive director of Beyond Plastics. Beyond Plastic has been on our radio show a couple of times. You know, Matt, what is sort of the goal of the Beyond Plastics campaign?
The goal is to really reduce plastics pollution here in New York and across the country. Plastics are choking our land and landfills and our oceans, and we're leading the fight to reduce the use of plastics and plastic pollution.
Now, both Albany County in particular, but also City of Troy, have taken some steps. Albany County and the City of Troy have both put fees on plastic bags. Albany County has banned styrofoam, but they haven't yet gotten to the plastic straws, and that legislation is being considered. Why is plastic straws such an issue these days?
Well, I think straws are a good example of the use of plastics that it's not really that necessary. Yes, it's a small thing, and not all of us use straws, yet they're foisted upon us whenever we go to a restaurant. And it's just we're looking for laws that make it that we only get straws upon request, is that we've got to start reducing our use of these materials, because in reality there's no safe way to dispose of this plastic. It's something we use for 10 or 15 minutes and then it goes in a landfill and is there for 400 years, or it's burned in an incinerator, or it ends up on the sidewalk and we walk by it. So what we're really trying to do is reduce the use of this, and that's the real answer to this problem.
And I was surprised to read a while back that the number of plastic straws in America is used and disposed of on a daily basis is somewhere between 200 to 500 million, which just sort of blew me away, you know, those type of numbers. But also plastic increasingly is a concern about a byproduct of from fracking waste and its whole impact in relationship to climate change.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about plastics is the whole life cycle of the material is of concern, from the production of it to the use of it to the disposal of it. And yes, the production is of concern. As many folks know, plastics is generally made out of 99% petroleum. And so it's the byproduct of making this is carbon, and it contributes significantly to climate change. And so while we definitely are focused on energy production for climate change and transportation, the production of plastics is growing as a significant contributor to climate change. And it's interesting, as we really try to cut back on our fossil fuel production for energy, plastics is coming in to fill that void. And so we need to be aware of these new facilities that are being built and being proposed across the country that are going to, you know, create an increased supply of plastics for us to use. So, and as you said, fracking in this region of the country is of concern, and a lot of the byproducts of fracking is used for the production of plastic.
Now, we're actually speaking in New York City. And as our listeners probably know, the state legislature picked up the New York City effort to ban plastic bags and has passed that at the state level, though unfortunately they did not include mandatory the fee on paper bags, which is why Albany County and City of Troy had to act. So what are some of the new things that New York City is looking at in plastic that eventually may migrate its way, you know, up the Hudson River?
Yeah, well, New York is actually considering a plastic straw ban, as we're talking about. And one of the interesting things is a focus on airports. And there's a movement to ban the selling of plastic water bottles at airports, because obviously there's a alternative that of using water fountains and reusable bottles. You talked about the figure of the amount of straws that we use. There's a equally as startling number as far as plastic bottles. Every minute, there's a million plastic bottles that are produced here in the world. You know, close to 500 billion, excuse me, annually across the world. And if you just think of that and the magnitude of that, it's just unsustainable. They're going to pile up on our landfills. There we see them on our streets. We really have to start pushing for ways that we reduce our use of these plastic bottles and, in general, single-use plastics.
I remember actually about 4 or 5 years ago when New York State expanded its bottle bill, and we were getting pushback from maybe the sports, one of the new containers. I actually at that point suggested, well, if they don't really like the idea, why don't we just ban these water bottles? And people thought that was too radical at that point. Yeah. Though apparently that seems to be gaining a little momentum.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the history of environmental protection and we look at the laws and policies that have really made a difference, it's been when we've banned things. We realized in the 60s that DDT, pesticide and insecticide, was very dangerous. And instead of just figuring out how to regulate it, we banned it. The same with lead and gasoline. Instead of eliminating it, we realized that we actually don't need it in gasoline, and so we banned it. And so when we look at issues like plastic and the dangers that it poses, I think we really need to be thinking about bans, because there are alternatives for our uses of many of the, certainly the single-use plastics that we right now are focusing in on.
Now, I know that there's some bills being pushed at the federal level. One of them has a nice name, can't quite remember, maybe Save Our Seas or something, but does not seem to be embraced by groups like Beyond Plastic. What are some of the problems with this federal so-called plastic bill being proposed?
Well, there's a couple of things that are wrong with it. One is that the focus is really on litter pickup. And that's not going to solve our problem. The litter problem is huge. And if we focus all of our energy on that, we're not going to get to the source of the problem, which is the production and use of these materials. The second thing is it doesn't address at all the impact of plastic production on climate change. We have to start talking about climate change when we're talking about plastic. It's the new big contributor to climate change. And if we really are going to comprehensively look at this problem, we need to look at plastic. And this bill doesn't do it. And then the final thing is that it's wanting to reopen the whole discussion of how can we, quote unquote, safely burn plastics. Time and time again, studies have shown the dangers of burning plastics in incinerators. It produces dioxins and dangerous chemicals. This bill wants to reopen that question and to spend more money on researching ways. They may call it different names, pyrolysis, or kind of put different tags on it, but it's the same old stuff of thinking we can solve this problem by burning our plastics, and in reality, that's not the case. So we're concerned about the dangers of that, and just, I think there's a problem in legislative bodies when they pass a bill which is weak, and then they wipe their hands of the problem. So what the SOS bill is, it's a false solution to a real increasing and looming problem that we face here in the Capital Region and across the country.
Is there a good plastic bill pending at the federal level at this point?
There is one that is being drafted right now by Senator Udall from New Mexico, which is a real comprehensive bill that looks at production, which looks at limiting use, and looks at opportunities for safe disposal of expanding bottle bills and figuring out how to clean our plastic waste stream to a point where we actually can recycle to a point some of these bottles.
We're talking to Matt Wilson, Beyond Plastic. About a minute left. End with a two-part question. Is there going to be an effort next session in New York State to try to further expand the bottle bill? What would that include? And if people want to find out more information about Beyond Plastics, assume you guys have a website?
Yeah, there's discussions in Albany about kind of what role does the bottle bill play in plastics pollution. And so there's discussions about exactly what that should be looking like, and there will be some movement on that. And yes, we're Beyond Plastics is a national group that provides assistance to community groups and individuals who might want to take on this issue in their towns, whether it's
website.
Website is beyondplastics.org.
It's been Matt Wilson. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
That was Matt Wilson, Executive Director of Beyond Plastic. He discussed his relationship between plastic, fracking, and the climate, and the campaign to curb single-use plastics, including straws.
A new talent in the Capital District, August, a.k.a. Extraordinaire, is in the studio with us today. He's a talented hip-hop Nuevo Soul artist. August/Extraordinaire has worked under several assumed names in his short career, Incoming and Extraordinaire. He has his own production company entitled Royal Kingdom. Welcome to the studio, August.
Thank you for having me.
So listen, what's going on with the name change? I have to start there. You know, I'm old. I have one name guy.
Traditional, yeah.
I've had one name my entire life. But, you know, I guess artists have multiple names. You know, like Prince was something else before he was Prince.
Very great.
Cher was something else before she was Cher. Mm. And August has got like two names. So what's up with the two names?
Okay, so I'll take you back to basically ground zero.
Incoming. Okay, 1961 before you.
Incoming is supposed to be the definition of how I always thought of music. Like, I think of it as incoming traffic because you never see it coming and you just have to take it when it comes. And it's going to always come off positive no matter what kind of instruments or no matter what kind of musical background I use. So Incoming was that part of me. That's my producing side. I started off with that around 2015.
All right, so I know you've got a little bit of your music for us. Can we hear a little sample?
Yes.
Can you cue it up for us? We just want to hear a little bit. Yeah. You know, Guy, I keep saying how old I am. but I'm down for new experiences.
I'm sure you'll like it.
Yeah, me too.
Here you go. It's called Legendary. You might want to turn that up. Told you like futuristic with the thoughts mold over in my head. Catch the bounce as I send you uptown.
Then pull your back downtown with the hammer skills. All right, all right. Hey, that's pretty good.
Got Livonia to dance.
Got me to, like, you know.
And it's right off the jump. Uh-huh. I had to learn how to do that. That's where the incoming side came in. Mm-hmm. I had a difficulty when I first produced with dropping a soundtrack within 15 seconds. As you saw, it didn't take me long. Mm. So Extraordinaire is basically supposed to be the rebirthed MC side of me where I can move the crowd in a matter of seconds and gravitate everyone in, kind of telling you a story, but I'm having a conversation with you at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I like the feel of that music. You're absolutely right. When it comes on, mm-hmm. you get pulled right into it. You know, it's got a heavy beat all the way around you, sort of surrounds you and makes you feel like you're entering a world when you hear it.
It's really epic.
Appreciate that. That's what I was going for.
Yeah, it is epic. It sounds like a soundtrack from some like movie or something, right? Some superhero or some sci-fi guy, you know? Really nice. I like that. Very nice stuff. So tell me, Royal Kingdom, you're producing your own stuff. You got your own label, Royal Kingdom. Royal Kingdom, what does that mean? And how can people like connect with Royal Kingdom?
Well, Royal Kingdom also intertwines with this snapback you see me wearing, Roar City. It's you're proud to represent the city you're from. Royal Kingdom is basically my castle. I'm the king, and I want to basically bring everyone in as a family. It's a universal thing. There's no discrimination. No one has to feel left out. I can collab with any artist. It doesn't matter who you are, and I'm not afraid to allow everybody to connect and become family. It's like a unification type of thing. Mm. It's all about love and positivity.
Yeah, bringing people together.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah, isn't that what music's supposed to do, right?
Right.
It's supposed to bring people together. And I like the ideal of, you know, you're not discriminating against anyone. So, you know, you can be a country artist and do work with you. You can be a rock artist, hip hop, soul, whatever, and really just come together and make music. That's a beautiful thing.
What kind of collabos have you done?
Well, I actually have projects in the making. Mm-hmm. There is an artist by the name of Rich Mills who I'm going to be working with. He originally was a battle rapper, but he also does do music. And we have currently been working on about 3 tracks. One of them is going to be called Royalty. Mm-hmm. It's going to be me, Extraordinaire, mm-hmm. Rich Mills, another artist by the name of De Niro Dream. Shout out to them because mm-hmm. they are like really close with me. Those are my brothers. And then I also have another project I'm going to be working on with a female artist. I can't give the name right now because we haven't come into exact permanent stone of the situation.
So you haven't worked out the paper agreement yet?
Correct, correct.
Yeah, see.
But I do.
See how cool I speak?
See, she's catching it. She's catching it.
I speak that language.
I'm glad you can connect with the lady because it's not easy. I always like to, you know, when it comes to this language and stuff, the way people make their records, you want people to understand what you're saying on your records. That's purposely why I speak the way I do on my records. Because at the end of the day, anybody can make a soundtrack. Anybody can make a song. But can you help people to relate to your music? Mm. And when they hear your music, do they feel angry? Or do they actually like, ooh, I like that.
Mm. Yeah.
I like to make music where it moves you.
Yeah. Mm. So there's a difference between soundtrack and music.
Very big
difference.
That's
the difference. You can make a soundtrack.
Just like there's a difference between being an MC and a rapper. Mm. A rapper can sometimes get put into the boat of just rhyming or flow rapping. An MC is the one that you don't need a beat. You could just say it off the dome, as they would call it in slang terms.
Say it off the dome.
Yeah, like you're literally, they say spitting lyrics off the dome. Like you're off the dome, spitting it, you hear a beat.
Oh, so the dome is like off the head, off the cuff.
Yeah, that one.
She caught it. I do have a special request I would like to play.
You want to play another song?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, let's hear some of your some more of your work. Let's hear something else. I like that first one, so I might like this one too, guy. I'm ready.
Ready to be moved.
This one is called Currency. The last one was called Legendary.
All right.
deal. Yo, 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 yo. Ain't coming. Turn me up. Louder. You don't understand. You can hear it. Louder. Wake up.
Got yeah. kind of a rock beat to it.
Yeah. That's what it might need to be in coming. There we go. Because it's about to get crazy. First off, let me start by saying this. Go hard. If a sucker wanna rob, he gonna catch it. No regard. Heard of 5 cents bird. No need to start front and back him down in the corner. Yeah, now who running? Packing heavy artillery for the long haul. Got the ingredients in the book. Ready to cook up and ball. Honey, make him dance. Party in the system. Feeling saucy.
That's very, very different sound than what we heard the first time. That really had like a rock feel coming you know, with that hard guitar.
I like to change it up a couple of times here and there. I get bored with music. And as you can see, it's like it can be a constant change. But at the same time, I will still keep the flow because it's all about what they call riding the wave of your soundtrack. As long as you can ride the wave, you will never lose your tempo. It's like an inevitable feat that you have to conquer when you're making a track. The moment you hit a track, come on, you are the track, especially if you're the producer, and you have to own it.
So, you know, before we close, we're so quickly running out of time. Tell my listeners, if they want to get some of your music, if they want to reach out to you personally, find out where your next event is, where you're producing, how can they contact you directly?
Okay, well, here's one here, Instagram.
Don't you have hashtags or
handle?
Something? Handle.
Yeah, my Instagram handle is A as in Apple, Z as in Zoe, A as in Apple, R as in Rover, O as in Octopus, T as in Toy, H as in Hello, E as in Echo, K as in King, I as in Igloo, N as in No, G as in Great, 94.
Wow. Okay. Got any other ways they can reach out to you? Got a Facebook page?
Yes, I do.
Phone number, website, you know, put it all out there.
All righty. And also, the Facebook is the business page. It's also connected to the Instagram. So every time I post to Instagram, it automatically goes to my Facebook business page incoming. That's the Facebook business page. I as in Igloo, N as in No, C as in Compton, O as in Over, M as in Mo, I as in Igloo, N as in No, G as in Great, and the Facebook actual name is Azaro King, just like you spelled it for the Instagram name.
All right. So listen, we're so happy that you came, take time to come in with us today, extraordinaire. Man, we wish you the best in your music career. We hope that you continue to grow and have continued success, and we love having you on another segment of Drop the Mic.
Before we close out, I would like to say one more thing. There is an upcoming album coming out December 4th. So keep that locked in. If you like that first song you just heard, you will hear the whole thing on that album. It's guaranteed.
All right. Thank you.
That was a little sneak peek.
All right. Thank you so very much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming in here today, August.
Thank you for having me.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm still Livonia Mallory.
And I have continued to be Guy Schaefer throughout this entire show. And you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM in Troy. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. That's 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming correspondent, labor correspondent, Willie Terry, was at the Troy Public Library on November 10th at a forum sponsored by the Troy Irish Genealogical Society entitled Troy's Draft Riot of 1863. The speaker was Michael Barrett, Executive Director of the Hudson Mohawk Industrial Gateway. In this part two segment, you will hear Willie Terry's interview with Michael Barrett about the 1863 Troy Draft Riot.
Now, there was a pictures you had jobs, you know, jobs, and then had no Irish.
Yes.
You know, and that kind of reminded me that back in the South, Jim Crow.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, you can go back centuries in Ireland and see that discrimination over there. Of course, a lot of it is
this ethnic. In America?
Well, that's America, oh, yes. Okay. But the aristocracy here in the U.S. tends to be English and Scots-Irish. And of course, they look down on the Irish Catholics in Ireland. So when they're over here and they're in charge, you know they're still going to look down on the Irish Catholics. And so, yes, there was blatant discrimination against the Irish, just as there were blacks. That was a fact of life. Henry Burton, I've mentioned him. The legends of Henry in this town, he was notoriously anti-Irish Catholic until really the buildup for the Civil War, when he had no choice but to hold his nose and start hiring them because he needed the manpower. So, okay, he'll tolerate Irish Catholics, but he was Scottish Presbyterian. And, Irish Catholics, the term at that time is teg. It's the exact same phrase with a certain N-word that we don't use today. Teg, that's the term against the Irish. They're tegs. Right. Ooh, yeah.
Now, let me ask you just a couple more questions, because I know you have to go. What was some of the areas in Troy that some of this history happened? Now, some of the streets or some of the...
The riot itself, literally comes all the way from Mill Street by Hudson Valley Community College today, all the way up to Mount Olympus, which is right there at North Street, just south of you guys at the sanctuary, and then back downtown. And through the nighttime, it's mostly from downtown and south. But the draft riot is a very wide area. A lot of the real violence is all clustered downtown, but an awful lot of the manpower, the people who came in and got swept up in this whole thing, start in South Troy, down in what was known as the Iron District or Scotch Hill area. Especially early on, the south end of the city was sparsely populated. It's certainly not South Troy that we recognize today. Right down to the Post and Kill was fairly well occupied, but then there's a very large stretch from the Post and Kill down toward the Foundries that is still farmland or pasture land, especially. Scattered businesses, but mostly it's wide open. If you look at the architecture there, it's pretty much post-Civil War. They came up to downtown because downtown was the center of everything, as it is. Well,
now, if someone wants to get some of that historical, things about the draft riot in Troy, where would they go get information?
The Troy Public Library here has got a number of the newspapers of the time on microfilm. Those are the best source you're going to find. But the one thing you always have to pay attention to is the newspapers of that day were very, very partisan. Most newspapers were in support of a political party of one stripe or another. So if you're reading the Troy Daily Times, this is the Republican newspaper. And if you're taking what they have to say as if it's gospel truth, you're going to make a serious mistake in checking your history. You need to counterbalance it by looking at the others. That's one of the issues about doing historical research at these times, back when, I like to think most media today is relatively neutral, but that's not true in the Civil War period. And so, there's some really, really stringent news editorials and news stories about the rioters. There are these hopelessly heathen, slope-headed Irish Catholics, who can't even breathe and walk at the same time. And really? That's my people you're talking about. Right. But So you need to take an awful lot of that with a big grain of salt, but that's the primary source. This city really needs a good written account of our draft riot. An awful lot of people say, well, Michael, you should do that. Yes, in my spare time. Yeah, let's see, Sunday afternoon. Oh, no, I don't have spare time on a Sunday afternoon. I'm down here. Yes, at some point, hopefully I'll retire and I'll sit down and I'll start writing stuff. But it's, we really do need, what we need is some nice young historians to get swept up in this and to start putting this stuff down on, well, not paper. I mean, I realize how much I'm dating myself when I say that, but at least write for, you know, the blog sites and the websites and the, get this stuff down. 'Cause an awful lot of historians, and I'm not a trained historian, I'm a historian by choice, but you know, when we're gone, you know, if my kids take all my files and throw them away, there's 40 years of research that's gone. So hopefully they're all going to a repository somewhere. And my kids, you know, I'm using a bad example with me. My kids recognize that my files, you know, if I go face down tonight, should go somewhere. Right. They're not going to chuck them, please.
But, well, maybe, you know, kids coming up, you know, well, they want to get involved in historical matters. Maybe this is something that they could do.
Yep, it is happening. It's gratifying in a sense that, yes, there are some very bright young historians who are coming out. And I actually just had a young lady in the museum the other day. She's working on a master's in museum studies down in Rhode Island. And she was home for a weekend and wanted to come and see the museum. And, you know, she said to me, well, I've got a half an hour. Can you really show me around in a half an hour? I said, sure, I can. You know, I can. 3.5 hours later, I'm throwing her out the door because I have a dinner date. You know, it's just like last call. Get out of my museum. But this is a young lady that whoever gets her, whatever job she finds after she gets her master's, somebody's going to be very lucky. I mean, just for 3.5 hours, excellent questions, and really, you could just tell she's percolating. She's excited. She's, okay. Ooh, yes.
Right. Yeah. Just one last question.
Yes.
And I want to ask you, because I know you're the executive director, and we should ask this, of the Hudson Mohawk Industrial Gateway, and I know that's the institute got some history behind it. So let's say people want to come there to get some information or to just learn about that. What do you have to say about
it? We'd love to have, you know, I'd love to have people in the museum. The biggest problem we have at the Burden Museum, which is what we run, it's a one-person operation. So we really strongly suggest that you make an appointment, you know, call ahead, email ahead, only because if you show up completely unannounced and I'm out at something else, you're out of luck. And so I always stress that. I hate to have, you know, come in after a meeting and somebody's on my machine saying, oh, we were there ringing the doorbell and nobody answered. Well, that's because you didn't tell me you were coming.
And what's the telephone number?
Area code 518-274-5267.
And the email?
Or email is info@HudsonMohawkGateway.org. That's all one word, Hudson Mohawk Gateway, just as it sounds. But yep, and those, of course, I can answer at 10, 11 o'clock at night. So email's a wonderful way to reach us. But, you know, we love to have people in. I'm actually just doing my numbers for last year for our annual report, and we had just under 1,800 visitors in 2018, and that's the lightest year I've had in a while. This year looks like it's going to be substantially more than that. We have a lot of people like this. We have fun there. It's just somebody's not sitting there twiddling their thumbs waiting for, yes.
Well, you might have one of those young historians get in touch with you.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so.
And there you have it.
I'm always looking. I'm actually wondering who's going to replace me because I'm getting a little long in the tooth here.
Yeah. We all, right?
Oh, yes.
And there you have it. Michael P. Barron, who's executive director of the Hudson Mohawk Industrial Gateway. And he's asking anyone out there to do something on the draft ride of 1863. And you could come and see him. He's a historian himself.
There you go.
Nice right, thank
to
you,
see
Mike.
You again. We'll take care.
All right, thank you, Mike.
It's a pleasure.
That was correspondent Willie Terry at the Troy Public Library on November 10th at the forum sponsored by the Troy Irish Genealogical Society entitled Troy's Draft Riot of 1863.
Up next, WOC correspondent Michelle Misurgeon interviews David Banks, a member of the Troy chapter of the Capital District Democratic Socialists of America. A Troy tenant town hall was held to discuss tenant housing issues and possible solutions for quality, affordable housing for all.
Okay, we're here today at the Troy Area United Ministries in downtown Troy, and it's a Troy tenant town hall, and I have a guest, and your name is?
David Banks.
And David, what is the name of the organization you represent?
I'm with the Democratic Socialists of America, in particular our Troy branch.
And what was the purpose of the tenant town hall?
So within the Troy branch, we have a housing working group, and we've identified renters and tenants as a really important part of organizing in the city. Troy has is a majority renting city, and so it faces similar problems that, say, New York City does, in that we have a high proportion of people renting and that they are subject to the whims of their landlord. And and if you have even just a couple of bad landlords, it can really take a big toll not only on property values and the quality of life of the city, but also like the health, well-being of the citizens.
So based on the little work groups that broke out today, what were some of the major issues and concerns that were pointed out?
So there were a couple of important takeaways. One is that even if you aren't a renter, bad landlords should be a very big concern for you. It's no fun to be the neighbor to a property that isn't well taken care of, and if a bad property is making the lives of its tenants hell and making it really bad, then they're not particularly, they're not going to be on their best mood. They're not going to, they're less likely to be, conscious of the people around them because they're dealing with so much more than they need to. And so what we've found that is important is that we, one, create more protections for tenants, enforce the protections we already have, both at the state and city level, and then also think creatively about what new mechanisms, policies, institutions we can build to make Troy a better place for renters.
So some of the issues that I heard was, suggestions was, and the most recent was there was a mention of land trusts.
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways that we can organized relationship to the land and property and shelter, right? And it's actually really only been since after World War II that the United States has been a majority purchasing with a mortgage and all in the nine yards sort of lifestyle. Prior to that, there were actually quite a wide range of ways that you could occupy land. And one that is seeing a resurgence that it is called a community land trust. And a community land trust, there have been many antecedents to it, were very different, but the modern land trust actually started in rural Albany, Georgia, from a group of black folks that were getting tired of their landlords, and they built up what was called the Community Land Trust. It still runs today. Probably the most well-known land trust, and the one that is the strongest, is the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Boston. And that land trust does two things really well. One, it provides affordable housing in perpetuity. And it does that through the second mechanism, which it separates the purchase of the property, like the land, from the edifice on top of it, the structure on top of it. So when you enter into an agreement with the CLT, with the land trust, they actually own the land. You do not own the land, and that's usually the case for most land trusts, is that you you don't own the land, you actually lease the building on top of it. And it's a very long lease. It's like a 99-year lease. And what that that difference does is, one, it limits equity that you can build. So that's the one downside, is that, like, you're not going to, like, make more than the market. You know, if you took the money that you put in to get this house from a land trust, you're not going to get the same sort of equity as if you put that same amount of money into, say, the stock market or something like that.
So the goal is more to stabilize housing instead of having a revolving door, and then it thus stabilizing a community.
Yes, yeah. Most people that buy into a CLT say that they didn't buy a house, they bought a community. And the goal is to say, you know, no, you're not going to use your house as your main investment vehicle for, like, retirement or build equity or something like that. We're making sure that housing, first and foremost, has a use value of a good place to live, and that all of those housing units are a good neighborhood. And so you don't build as much equity, but the benefit from that is that you have a bunch of people that don't want to move, that they build a strong community, and that they're all living there affordably and happily.
So I understand in Troy they have a landlord registry, but there is no residential occupancy permit. So we were discussing what tenants can do when they go to building codes and something more proactive.
Yeah. Yeah. So we learned today that a lot of us learned that, you know, when you go to become a landlord in Troy, you have to register, and you register once and that's it for the rest of your life, which is less than the sort of registry that we use for dogs. Right. So, you know, and it costs less to be a landlord than to own a dog in Troy. And so that's obviously a problem. And so what we're going to do instead, or what we would like to see done instead, is create maybe like an annual licensure to be a landlord, and then also enforce what already exists in terms of code enforcement, maybe extending code enforcement into the home and in between tenants, instead of just like so it's a little bit more proactive, instead of like waiting for someone to call code enforcement, because there's a lot of good reasons why people would be reticent and hesitate to call code enforcement if you know, like, they've already been harassed by the police or something like that, and code enforcement is part of the police. So another big part and a big innovation that might be really important to get people to report more in code enforcement is to disconnect that department from the police department and have a more civilian-oriented code enforcement that cares more about making sure people are living in a healthy and happy place than punitive measures to the people that live on the property.
And then what about the issue of a tenant union, that discussion topic?
Yeah, so a tenant's union, typically we think of unions as something that you build at work. And if you build a union where you live, right, maybe in a building, everyone in one building becoming part of a union, or everyone in a city becoming one big union, is you develop a few things. One, you pool resources. So if you're having a problem, you can go to other people in your union, go to your rep in your union, and ask for advice. Just asking for advice can be huge. You can also ask for recommendations for, you know, people to fix things. If your landlord says, I can't find anyone to fix, you know, your faucet or your ceiling or something like that, you know, if you're part of a union, you can have a pool of, like, ready, good, vetted contractors to fix something. But then if stuff gets antagonistic and your landlord isn't doing something that you needed them to do, then the union becomes powerful in that you aren't alone in that struggle. And so it's one thing if you as one person say like, oh no, please give me back my security deposit. But if everyone in the city that's part of that union says, give me back my security deposit, that's a bit much bigger.
So in wrapping up, will there be a continuing meeting, and how could people join in and learn about what you folks are doing?
Yeah, so the Housing Working Group of the Democratic Socialists of America in Troy are holding another one of these meetings November 18th. That's a Monday at the Troy Public Library. You can just drop in. It starts at 6 p.m. And just come on in, and we'll be happy to have you.
Do you folks have a website?
Yes. Yeah, you can visit us on our website at capitaldistrictdsa.org. That's for our entire chapter, which includes Albany, Saratoga, and hopefully Schenectady and a couple other outlying counties.
And everybody is welcome to come to this meeting?
Everyone's welcome to come to that housing meeting and all DSA meetings.
Okay, and I want to thank David Banks from DSA. And this is Michelle signing off for the Upstate Housing Program. Thank you.
That was David Banks from the Capital District Democratic Socialists of America discussing tenant housing issues in the city of Troy with WOOC correspondent Michelle Mersurgeon. Reminder, the documentary film, I Am Warrior Woman and Housing Injustice, will be showing Monday, November 18th, 7 p.m. at 259 Orange Street in Albany, free and open to the public.
And now to close out the show, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Chet Hardin, an investigative journalist who wrote for Metroland on Nexium and Keith Raniere. He also co-authored the book, The Program, Inside the Mind of Keith Raniere. Chet will be giving a workshop on the art of investigative journalism at the Sanctuary for Independent Media on Monday, November 18th.
How did you first hear about Nexium? You know, what was the tip?
I first heard about Nexium. I was given I was at Metroland. I'd only been there for about a month, and a call came in from a person who had worked with Nexium, and he wanted to. He wanted to get news out about the organization. He was concerned with some of the things they were doing, so he was kind of like a whistleblower, I guess. But he wasn't working for them anymore when he called me.
So when you got that tip, what did you do next?
I ran over to his office. Because the way he presented it was that he had a story about a group that someone might call a cult. So I was, I was very interested immediately. So I went over and I started, I just started talking to him, going through the documents he provided. He connected me with other sources, and I just kept following. You know, I kept following the trails. The thing about that story was that there were so many paths to go down. There were so many people to talk to. It was very rich. There was really no fighting to get information in that first article I did. It was just waiting to be told.
So how did you keep track of all of that information? And what sorts of documents were you looking at and sources were you talking to?
It's funny when I look at that story, I think it was the second or third really like big story I'd written. And by big, I mean just by word count, not topic, subject matter. It was kind of chaotic. It was drinking water from a fire hose, as the old saying goes. And I was just getting so many stories from sources, and trying to keep track of those notes and those recordings was... I'm sure now I would laugh at the way I was doing it. It was chaos. But the documents I was looking at were some work product that my source provided. You know, one of the documents that I reported about was a dossier that was prepared on cult deprogrammer Rick Ross. He was one of Nexium's chief enemies, and they had hired espionage firm out of New York to spy on him. And in this dossier that I had, it had his banking information. So I called Rick and confirmed that the banking information was accurate. And that led to some legal actions for him. But, you know, it was a lot of work product that I was looking at, some legal cases, you know, lawsuits.
So you're going to be teaching a workshop on investigative journalism, and you say that you would laugh to look back now on how you were handling it. What advice would you give to journalists now who are trying to balance so much information?
Just being hyper-organized, keeping track of every document, where you get it, not throwing anything away, not discounting anything, keep a hold of everything you get, keep it extremely well organized. Use whatever means are most comfortable to you. You know, I like physical documents, so I like to print things off and keep them in file folders. Maybe you're more comfortable working with, in online media, in the cloud or something. But I'm not. I need that sort of like those physical documents to write on and keep in a folder. I guess my best advice is that organization matters. Almost as much as the research that you do, because if you can't immediately grab it, if you're not able to connect those dots, you're only hurting yourself.
So how did you make decisions about what sorts of information to include in your writing and the timing of releasing the articles?
That's a great question, because that's the thing that, you know, you're always going to be struggling with, what to put in and what not include. If you can't vet some information by, you know, its veracity, whether it's, you know, if it's true or not, if you have doubts about it, it's best to leave it out. For me, if I try to get into the weeds on something, if I try to get real specific, that's usually when I can mess up. So if I'm going to get really specific, you really have to be careful. It's never the big thing that gets you. It's always those little things that you assume as a fact, and then it just messes you up. When I'm deciding what to include, you know, obviously it's whatever best gets the narrative across for the story, and whatever fact I think is the most critical for, you know, the general public to know. With Nexium, that first story, there was no delete button, I think, when I wrote that story. I just, everything went in, you know, everything I could get went into that story. Now, again, years later, I would go back to that story and I would have written a very different article. But then everything went in, because it was all new and fascinating, you know, and no one had really reported it.
What happened after the story was released?
Well, immediately after, I was contacted by Nancy Saltzman, the president of Nexium. She wanted to have a meeting to discuss the article. They claimed that I had never reached out to get their comment, which was not true. And, you know, so I had a meeting with her. She wasn't happy with the story, obviously. A lot of people in the community were torn on it. I think a lot of people read the story and thought, well, I bet you 20% of this is true. I bet you 30% of this is true. There was a lot of disbelief, and for good reason. I mean, the story sounded kind of crazy, you know? I mean, there were a lot of intense allegations in that original story. And it's hard to believe that something like a Nexium is occurring in Knoxwoods. It's hard to believe that. Even though my story didn't even scratch the surface of what actually was going on, even at that time, it was still kind of beyond belief. I remember I was confronted in a bar in Troy by a person who had gone through some executive success program training. And he thought I was crazy. He thought it was a complete smear, hit job. He didn't understand how I could have done something like that. So I think that it, it you know, the response definitely ran the gambit as far as that's concerned.
Can you talk about the midnight game of volleyball?
Sure, yeah. And I'm going to talk about that much more at the Sanctuary. But it was, you know, it was an odd, it was about as odd as you would expect a midnight game of volleyball to be.
Just for our listeners, this game was with Allison Mack, Seagram's heiress Claire Bronfman, and Keith Raniere himself.
Yeah, it was, like I said, I'm going to go into more detail about it at the Sanctuary event, but it was, I wasn't afraid. I wish I'd handled it better, you know, again, being an older journalist now, I look back at that guy and I'm like, man, why didn't you, like, put a microphone in your shoe or something, you know? Why did you go into there without any sort of, like, plan to, like, why didn't you write about it the next day? You know what I mean? Like, there are things, I didn't write about it for some reason. I didn't publish a story about it. I should have, you know? I'd only been a journalist for 3 years at that point, so I still kind of consider myself a rookie, and those are the kind of things you just don't think about. And that's one of the values of, like, local journalism and institutionalized journalism, is that I had nobody to help me with that. You know what I mean? I, like, Metroland was awesome, but Metroland was also very much hands off, you know. You went in, you wrote your stories, you could say pretty much whatever you wanted to, and you got out. And I, you know, I've worked at other papers. The paper I worked at, actually, after Metroland, I worked with reporters and editors with decades of experience, and they never would have let me get away with not writing about that volleyball game. You know, they would have been on the phone with me the second I got out of there, no matter what time of night it was. So the value that we're losing in journalism isn't just the value of people who are curious. Everyone's, you know, lots of curious people. And you're not really losing the value of access to people's attention, because, you know, anybody can start a blog, and anybody can start a podcast, and you can get attention for these things. But what we've lost is that institutional knowledge, and that's the worst part of it. We're losing that connection to people who have decades of experience. They're going off and, like, you know, doing PR and other things like that.
And that was our special correspondent, Alexis, speaking to Chet Hardin about Metroland and NXIVM and Keith Raniere and the book, The Program Inside the Mind of Keith Raniere. And Guy, guess what?
Is it that time again?
It is. Man, it went by so quickly.
It was a quick one today.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm still Livonia Mallory.
And I've continued to be Guy Schaefer throughout the entire show. And our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith.
Woo, woo, woo.
Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
That was supposed to be a cheer. That was more dog-like, I think. As a reminder,
I got the feeling.
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with this radio station, send us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday night at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks,
thanks for tuning in.